you got your apprenticeship in magazines working at Penthouse. Why did you want to learn the trade? You didn't. I don't expect your father forced you to work there.
No. In fact, he fired me twice. I got fired early on as a teenager because I went out with a receptionist. And that was a no-no.
Was that policy? No one could date anyone on the staff?
No one called Guccione could date anyone on the staff. No, it was kids. And the second time he fired me for coming in late, quite deservedly, he fired me. But he did want me to get involved in the company business. And he did want me to, the family business, rather. And he did want me to take over. And I spent my 20s in and out of the business during two periods of which I was the circulation director for the company. And I really just didn't like working for anybody else. I happened to love my old man. It was the only job in the world I probably could have worked for. But, you know, I was a writer at heart, and I kept leaving the company to go and write, and I'd write for 2 and 3 year periods, writing novels and fiction, none of which got published. I published some journalism. And I kept getting drawn back to the business because it excited me, but I really didn't want to work in the family business. I didn't really want to be, at the very best, a number two. You know, I always wanted to really have my own thing. And so when I thought of Spin Magazine, you know, 2 years ago, that was it for me. It was vocational.
Well, it's hard to take orders from someone in your family at business and then have them have the upper hand in the family also.
Absolutely. See, I mean, I love my old man, and my old man loves me. I call him my old man affectionately. I picked that up when I was 12 years old, and I heard him call his father his old man. And that, to me, was, you know, the okays from the gods to pass on that word, so that's what I did. But as close as we are, we're very similar in many ways. We're both very creative. And in my capacity at Penthouse, whenever I had a creative idea, it was always subject to whether or not I agreed with his creative opinion, which invariably he was right, as it happened, because it was his magazine. He had an understanding for it. Just as today, invariably I may be correct on a creative decision for Spin because it's my magazine, my idea, my thought. I wouldn't be so good if I walked into somebody else's office and made decisions.
What were some of the ideas that you came up with that were put into effect or that you wanted to have put into effect?
Well, one success that did happen was an ad we ran. We had done an article on Jerry Falwell exposing him. A very, very strong, powerful article. And I ran an ad in most of the major newspapers in America with a picture of Falwell, his arms outstretched, and a particularly sort of, you know, self-satisfied look on his face. And the headline read, "He may not be pet of the month, but he's uncovered in this issue of Penthouse." And the ad got terrific play. You know, a lot of people wrote about the ad and of course, paid attention to the article. My father liked that one very much. But there are other times when I want to do a subscription ad a certain way or a TV ad a certain way, and he didn't. And I just recognized all along that really I had in me a great burning desire to have my own field of expression.
Another thing about Penthouse, you were fired altogether 3 times, I think, or twice?
I think I was fired twice and I left 3 times.
Okay. Yeah. When you were fired, how did you get rehired again?
Oh, I was only 16 when he fired me the first time and 18 when he fired me the second time. So there was plenty of, time left to get rehired.
Did you ask to come back or did he ask you?
No, I don't think. I think we just started talking about it one day over dinner or something. It was like, well, why don't you come back and work for the company? Yeah, I want to or whatever. Or I said, I'd like to work for the company, you know. It was sort of, I think really, when you think about it, we're very close as a father and son. And my father's close to all of the kids. In his perspective, and probably in mine, I had never really left. I just hadn't gone back to work for one reason or the other, you know.
Did you feel attuned to the sensibility of Penthouse magazine? And I think, for instance, you say it's your father's idea and it's his sensibility and he's from a different generation. And I think, well, I'm not really sure what the demographics of the magazine are.
Well, demographics are definitely my age group. In fact, I'm probably a touch old from now.
Really?
Yeah, I'm 30. So it's probably really more mid to late 20s, and skewing towards my age on a thinner end. But it is my sensibility. I think, you know, I relate to the magazine editorially. I'm so used to seeing what goes into it, of course. I mean, I've been seeing nude women in print since I was 9 years old, but that's not going to have the same effect or impact or thrill to me that does to an average reader. But in terms of not being tuned into it in a business sense, you know, Spin is breaking new ground, and for me, Penthouse wasn't breaking new ground. For me, I mean, the magazine continues to break new ground for my father. You know, he still edits the magazine 21 years later, you know, so he still gets a thrill, but
It's funny when I think of all the fathers who tried to hide their sex magazines from their sons. And, of course, your father had you come work for his.
Yeah. I used to work from when I was nine. I used to be, you know, in the mailroom stuffing things in envelopes. He was always sharp. He knew when he could get free labor, you know.
What were your first reactions when you first saw the magazine?
Oh, there were none. I mean, you know, I was just, I had no idea what it was. I had no idea what sex was at nine. I had no erotic urges until I was about 11 or 12 of any sort, you know, and I think my first erotic urge was for Sandy Shore, who was a singer in England. I didn't understand it. So the magazine certainly didn't, you know, have any meaning to me at that age. And my father was very open about it, too, so there was nothing hidden. Therefore, there was no enigma to it, you know. And in fact, once when I was in school, I asked a priest, dead seriously, I asked a priest how babies were born. And he thought I was mocking the church and slapped me. And I was so hurt, because when a priest hits you, when you're a kid and you're going to a Catholic school, that's like, God okayed that, you know that. You know, that came down from high, you know. So I figured I was in trouble with heaven. And I explained, and I cried. I said, look, I just don't know. And he realized it was true, and he told me. And it was shocking, you know, to me, as it is to every kid when they first hear. But Penthouse has been in publication for 4 years, and I just didn't connect that sex and childbirth were there, you know.
Did you talk to your father about that?
Oh, yeah, jokingly. He started to tell me the facts of life at about 16, and I said, actually, I sort of caught up now. I kind of know. Thanks, but, you know.
My guest is Bob Guccione Jr., and he is the editor and publisher of Spin Magazine, which is a rock magazine that is about 1.5 years old now?
Just under. About one year, four months.
So you didn't want to work for your father's magazine. You wanted your own magazine. Why did you want it to be a rock magazine?
Well, rock and music in general is a great solvent, upon which if you put any message on that solvent, that will go straight into the bloodstream. It's an emotional medium, rock and roll, much more than, say, a news magazine or even fashion or sports or whatever. Because music, in a sense, musicians are our licensed outlaws. I think every society needs a sort of escape valve, needs a blow-off steam valve. And in our society, rock and roll is that. That's why it's sort of so rebellious, you know. If a stockbroker is outrageous, he doesn't last long on Wall Street. You know, if a priest is outrageous, he gets thrown out. If a lawyer is outrageous, it gets debarred. But a rock and roller can be as outrageous as he wants, and there's nothing but infinite capacity for that. That's society's way of releasing steam. It's its catharsis. And henceforth, given that tremendous freedom, you get a lot of poetry, a lot of good messages, a lot of intelligence, a lot of sensitivity, a lot of great acuteness about the world comes through the music. So people are receiving good messages. After all, guys like Henry Miller were writing the same sort of stuff that musicians have been writing for 20, 30 years in rock and roll songs. Henry Miller used to be banned and hated, you know, for his literature. Stuff now that is taught in schools as pure literature, same with D.H. Lawrence. It's been harder for literature to have the same message. The music just simply, you know, drops in your lap in 3 minutes.
Have you always listened to a lot of rock?
No, not really, no. I was 15 before I think I really paid any attention to it. It was only when we moved back to America, my family. And I went to high school, and high school was completely coated in music. So I got into it, and I loved it. I might have got into it, but before that, I was only into soccer and being an altar boy and trying to work out what girls did.
You grew up where, in England?
I grew up in England, yes.
So you wanted to do a music magazine. Did your father offer to help you out with the financing?
Yes, he did, yeah. I had started to prepare a business prospectus, and I was going to go to other people for financing. But just out of respect and, you know, love, I went to him first, never expecting him to agree to it. Not even sure that I wanted him to, because I thought maybe, you know, it wasn't the sort of magazine that Penthouse should put money into and shouldn't drain their corporate finances. They have their own businesses and all that. But he liked the idea, liked the dummy, and said, look, I'll lend you the money, but you've got to pay it back. And then that was it. So I didn't look any further. I'd have been a fool to look further than that, you know.
Interest?
Interest in the magazine?
No, interest on the loan.
No. No interest on the loan.
What did you want to do differently than what you saw already being done in the rock press?
Well, everything. You know, the rock press was divided into two categories. The one category was the sort of inane pulp fanzine aimed at, and even then dramatically underestimating and insulting 14-year-olds. But that's okay, you know. I mean, they expect their market to go to 15 and grow out of them. They make good living that way. But I couldn't find anything that was interesting there. And the other end of the market was All Alone, just Rolling Stone, you know, leader of a field of one, a and very content with themselves for that. And they had become so deadly ponderous. And they began to regard each issue, I think, as the tablets, sort of an endless stream of tablets coming down from the mountain, you know, and they had no fun in them, no excitement in them, utterly predictable, utterly stuffy. And it just struck me one day that the rock and roll press lacked the very irreverent humor and sensitivity that characterized the music itself. And that if one opened a magazine that was fun as well as honest, you know, and would go into some small dark club and say, we like this music, even though no one else writes about it and they don't go on MTV and they're not played, but we like them. You know, shucks, maybe we're wrong. You know, and we did that. And that is the excitement of new music.
There's a lot of rock that is almost like art music in that some people know about it, most people don't. It's not played on the radio. It's on small labels, independently produced. Mm-hmm. How much do you like to cover music like that? Because it's not necessarily going to have a wide following.
Well, we're the only magazine that covers the underground, for instance. Underground is all those independents you're talking about, and especially the very non-commercial and particularly hardcore bands. We cover those. And we cover African music, reggae, with any major magazine that covers that stuff. And we go way out. I mean, we've covered everything from Philip Glass to Fela. We were the first magazine to write about Fela, and we got, in fact, in the new issue now, the one you're just looking at, we have the first interview he's given since he got out of jail. And he gave it to us because he said, hey, the only people in the world who cared when we were in jail was Spin, because we wrote about him a few times while he was in jail, just saying he's still there and blah, blah, blah. It's a shame, it's a crime. So, you know, we've really got a diverse range.
You're also the design editor, is that the right word?
Design director, yeah.
Design director, thanks, of the magazine. And I noticed that Spin, in a lot of ways, seems to have borrowed, as I think some other rock magazines have too, from the fashion world in its sense of layout and color. And,
yeah.
And I wonder why you think that's happening.
Yeah, well, actually, I very consciously laid the magazine out based on European fashion magazines. That idea, I think it's different because the subject matter is different and we get some very dramatic layouts. Fashion magazines don't really have editorial. They have pictures and ads, you know. That is their editorial. We have long stories, 3,000-4,000-word, 5,000-word stories. So the layout is, of course, different there. But the sense of it, the book in general, is very definitely European fashion, just because it's exciting and visual.
Yeah, what interests you in fashion magazines?
Just the excitement of the visuals and the layouts.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's all it is. Because I'm not particularly, you know, interested in... I won't put fashion in Spin, for instance. You know, it just doesn't... For me, it doesn't belong. It doesn't work.
There are, in record magazines, usually a lot of record company advertising, and I think that record companies sometimes have certain expectations when they're buying ads, which is that their records will be reviewed, and sometimes that their records will be reviewed positively.
Yeah, they have that expectation on us
once. Have you run into that?
All the time, yeah. Well, not all the time. I've run into a few times. In all fairness, I don't want to taint the whole industry, but we've had a couple of companies have directly said that to us. One company just threw their ads out. So that's it. You can't come back in until you apologize. And not only that, if I don't think the apology is enough because they were rude to my social publisher, the ad director, I said, it's not even if she accepts the apology, I have to accept it because you can't insult our magazine because you insulted me now. The core of the magazine is its integrity. And they said, you're not writing enough about our bands. I said, your bands aren't interesting. So we put ads in the magazine. I said, our magazine's interesting. As an audience, that's why you put ads in. You don't want to put ads, don't put them in. And this escalated till they threatened us. And I said, fine, that's it, throw them out. And another record company, too, tried a little bit of that. And we just said, don't even try it because your advertising just doesn't matter to us. It's that simple. You know, I mean, we carry, in terms of advertising, we essentially carry the liquor and the cigarettes and the cars and the stereos and other stuff, fashion even, that far more outweighs the record company advertising. And to me, the reader can always sense when a magazine has compromised itself. There's something in the tone. Just as when you're talking to somebody and you see something in their eyes that tells you that they're lying. So with the magazine, I think you can tell, you can sense it. You can't find that in Spin because we just don't allow it. You know, we may sometimes give a tremendous review to somebody who just doesn't deserve it, but that was honest. You know, at the time, we felt that. We also do it the other way. We often give bad reviews to people who deserve better, and we're just not always right, of course.
One of the contests, actually, that you've run that is still in progress now, mm-hmm. got a lot of press coverage, and that's the Sean Penn photograph. Explain the contest.
Yeah, what that was I'd read a couple of items in succession where he had beaten up one, first an old photographer and then somebody else. And then I was in L.A. and I heard how the night before in a club he'd hit a guy from behind. Sean Penn, this is. And that strikes me as such inutterable cowardice. First of all, the photographer he hits is 61 years old. You know, another guy he hit was a small guy, and the guy in the club he hits from behind. So we started to run a series of little items in the magazine in a flash. The first one of which, and I wrote them personally, so I'm glad to take credit for this, you know, because I can't stand this guy. And I never met him, but I can't stand anybody who's a bully. That's what he is to me. I wrote a thing saying, is Sean Penn the Jerry Cooney of photography bashes? You know, and then it went on to say, is he falsely building up his record against weaker opponents? And then the next month we ran another little item in which we quoted Ron Galella as saying, Ron Galella gave us this quote, he's a pipsqueak, you know, I fought Brando, I fought Jackie O, all in this boxing parlance, just joking, really making fun. And then one day just struck me as, we'll have the Sean Penn photo contest. Just let him know what I really think of him. Simple as that.
But on one level, who cares what you think of him? Do you know what I mean? Like, well, why use your magazine for a personal expression of what you think of him?
Because the whole magazine is a personal expression. It's not all what I think, but it is all what somebody thinks. Any writer in any story usually puts himself into his personality. We try to eliminate the sort of I, me, me, my journalism. You know, the stories are not about the writer. But if the writer's a good writer, he brings an opinion to it. And I write editorials in Reissue, you know, and they're always very opinionated. And quite frankly, I just think the magazine without an opinion is a wimpy magazine. You know, and we are, after all, a cultural magazine. We're reflective of the society that we're in, and he's part of that society. You know, in a sense, I'm kind of giving him back a little of the treatment he's giving, but nobody's getting hurt.
But why spend so much energy taking a stand on Sean Penn's attitude towards photographers?
Didn't spend that much energy, let me tell you. But I would spend more. I think he's a bully, and I think that someone should call him on it. And I think the rest of the media tends to use Sean Penn like the sort of hand puppet. They use all the other celebrities. You know, they wave in front of the audience and they buy the newspapers and the magazines and the TV show. And that's fine. We do it too. You know, we put celebrities on the cover of the magazine.
It got a lot of press coverage. Did you do it?
It's a funny item.
Did you do it in part to get the press coverage?
I don't think I did, and I'm trying to really be honest here. I don't think I really sat down and calculated how much coverage we'd get, but I knew it would get picked up. And that was part of my fun in it. I said, good, he's going to get his, you know, he's met a match here. You know, I mean, I'm a physical match for him too. He wants to hit me, you know, he won't want to hit people after he hits me. But I wanted to match mentally with him, you know, because I can't, you know, it's funny, you got me on a sore subject here. I just don't like bullies. And that's, you know, I mean, he's a celebrity. He makes his living being a celebrity. You know, guy's trying to make his living, take his picture. You either ask him politely or you walk away or you give him a picture or whatever. You don't have to hit the guy. Not when he's 61 years old anyway.
My guest is Bob Guccione Jr., who is the editor and publisher of Spin Magazine. Your July issue has an investigative story that's also gotten a lot of attention, and it's a story about how the Live Aid money is being used. And the report that you've published suggests that it's doing more harm than good. Let me ask you to briefly summarize the results of the investigative piece that you've printed.
Well, we looked into what the money did when it got to Ethiopia. We found what happens to it is that it is completely absorbed by the Ethiopian government. The government controls 100% of all the funds, controls all of the transporting of all of the relief food, and that it only uses it where and when it wants to. And it uses it as bait and traps to lure the civilians out of the hills, off the plains, and then puts them on to resettlement marches, captures them and puts them on resettlement marches, which divide the country, split up the country. You know, Ethiopia's been at civil war for 25 years. For the past 10 years, this government, since it's been in power for just over 10 years, has tried to pull off this resettlement program and has failed because it didn't have the food. It had the hardware, the trucks and the planes. The Russians had sold them those. But it needed the food to lure people. People were hungry. The people are hungry. The famine, by the way, is at least two-thirds government policy and one-third nature. It's an unnatural famine, not a natural one, because the government has created a famine by taxing its people in food. And it just increased the taxes to buy more and more arms. And secondly, the government goes into the rebel-held territories and napalms the land. So even if they are growing something, just napalms, that's the end of that. Most people don't realize that. They don't realize half the things we uncovered in the article. That's why the article was so, you know, shocking.
Why did you put one of your reporters on the Live Aid story?
Because it was a natural story a year after Live Aid to see what happened to the money. And we did not know. I had a suspicion because I'd read certain things in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal a couple of times. I'd read that, you know, Ethiopia was at civil war and that food had rotted on docks and, you know, that all was not as rosy as you might think over there. And so I realized it was a politically complex situation and there must be something to do. Anyway, we just started out to investigate what happens to the funds in Ethiopia. And my sister actually broke the story. She was researching it. And she came back with some very heavy clippings. She said, look, all this points up to something. And we read them. And then we knew, her and I knew a guy who publishes a military magazine, a military trade magazine. We spoke to him and he took us some interesting sources. We actually wound up interviewing people in the Ethiopian government, defectors, Ethiopian defectors, refugees, people in relief agencies in Ethiopia and outside.
It was suggested in a couple of articles that your story, your magazine story on the Live Aid money was done and was played up in an attempt to get publicity for the magazine. What do you say to that?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, the story stands completely, 100% valid. Even the people who attacked it, including Bob Geldof, did not deny a single piece of evidence. That was the key thing in his prepared statement he released to the press. Not a single piece of evidence was refuted. In fact, in the first line, he kind of admits that, yeah, we got it right, but it's not our fault, you know. So that's number one. Number two, that would hold up. The criticism that we were sensationalizing an issue would hold up if the article wasn't 100% correct. And number three, some of the press has now turned around and started supporting us because what happened was they thought, coming from a new rock and roll magazine, this was just an attempt to gain publicity, quite naturally. The Sean Penn photo contest was much more of a publicity-type thing. You know, we did sit down and say, this will get to pick up. This is fun. Let's do it. It's irreverent. Bang, let's do it. But Live Aid, we were very, very, very careful with because we wanted to get the story 100% correct. It was something we believed in from the moment we started on it. In fact, we held it back from the press right until press date because we wanted to continue to research it until the last possible moment so we'd have ammunition for what we considered that the attack would be. And just recently, just last week, the Wall Street Journal printed an editorial, you know, I don't know if you saw it, called Death Aid, in which it just was the first of the major media to come out and say, hey, spin's right. And they praised us. Their actual wording was, spin should be praised for bringing this unpopular truth to its readers. And that while the Queen was knighting Bob Geldof, Spin was introducing its readers to Colonel Mengistu. And, you know, it's something that they had, and they said, we have reported on this before, meaning we, the Wall Street Journal, have reported on this before, and that Spin is accurate, 100%. You know, so I wonder, you know, of course, that criticism is understood. I mean, I'm a big boy now. I'm in the adult world. I don't expect to not be criticized for things. But I wonder if Geldof would have said the same thing in his statement had Time magazine broke the story, or would the press accuse Time magazine of seeking publicity?
Your magazine is a little under a year and a half old. Can you tell yet if it can survive?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's very, very, very strong. We haven't broken even yet, but in the magazine business, you're not expected to break even for several years. We could break even within three, which would be really sensational.
Do you get any advice from your father now on the magazine world?
Yes, I do. You know, I go to him a lot and just say, hey, what would you do here? What would you do there? And last night, before I came out of Philadelphia this morning, I was at his house. He has a gym in the house, and I was using the gym because I'm too late to have another gym. And as I'm leaving, and I'm tired, and I want to go home and get up early, as I'm leaving, he says, hey, come here, I want to show you the covers. And we chose a Penthouse cover together. So he asks me about certain things, and I go to him and ask him for his advice. Now, he's been around the block a lot longer than I have, you know. I mean, he's been in publishing 21 years. And I've been in and out of it for the last 10, but only really, really, really in it in the last two with my own magazine. So I'm very, very, very grateful for that.
He's really one of the most controversial people in magazine publishing.
He's one of the, I don't mean to cut you off, I just mean he's one of the boldest. And there's not many bold people in magazine publishing anymore.
I wonder what expectations people have of you knowing that your father is Bob Guccione.
Interestingly enough, I don't think yet people have that many expectations of me. I'm still a bit of an anomaly. I'm either the rich kid who got lucky, which is a common misconception, or I'm like not known at all. you know, I think now spin is beginning to carve, I say it's beginning to carve its own mark in the world. And people begin to say, well, who is the editor of this? Ah, familiar name. You know, and I'm happy to say I think that personally my own impression of people's impression of me and my own reputation will be founded on spin.
Everybody knows that your father's rich, and being the offspring of somebody rich is something that some people flaunt, that other people are kind of embarrassed of and don't want people to know because they know that some people don't have money and they have mm-hmm. so much. What has your attitude been toward that, toward knowing that your family has money and knowing that other people know that your family has money?
It's somewhere in the middle. I mean, it's really not in the middle. It's just a completely third, different view. It's neither as good as some people would think, and it's certainly not as bad as some people make it out to be. I've known some kids of very famous and prominent and wealthy people, and they were totally screwed up. And I said that one guy said to me once, he says, you've got to understand, I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I said, you were born with it in your backside, not your mouth. I mean, you know, you've got to take care of your own life, you know. I hope I don't offend your listeners saying that. I almost said another word. And, you know, each person has their own life to lead. I mean, that's, you know, we're all lucky in some ways, we're all unlucky in others. I mean, I am really a lucky person, you know, and I thank God for that. I mean, I've got a lot of luck. And as far as my father's wealth goes, he is a self-made man, which is very inspiring. And when I grew up, I was 17 before he made any money. So I was actually out the door. I'd already left home within the same 6 months as he finally broke even on Penthouse. And then, you know, obviously went on to be very wealthy. But before 17, I had ingrained in me my own dreams, my own fantasies, my own fairy tales of what life should be. And I wanted to be a writer, and writers were penniless, and that was okay by me. And for years, I drifted around as a penniless writer. In fact, when I was married, my wife supported us. I was married briefly. My wife supported us while I wrote. You know, it wasn't that I was stupid. I didn't know there had since become money in the family. It's just that it wasn't important to me. What was important to me were my dreams. And now, as a businessman, I realize that there's a terrific value to having that money available. If it helps spin to get off the ground, as it did, that's great. I don't flaunt the money. I don't have it. A lot of people don't realize that, too. My father doesn't give us money. He worked for him. He'll pay you a salary. And in my case, he invested in my magazine, and I pay myself an incredibly small salary. I'm in this for the long haul, not for the short one. But one good thing about my family is my father never spoiled any of us. So all of us grew up with a good sense of values.
What did he do when you were growing up for a living?
Well, he was a publisher. He started publishing Penthouse in 1965. Before that, he was a painter. And he was as penniless as a church mouse. I mean, really poor, my mother and he, because he couldn't sell any paintings.
So you plan on staying in the magazine business?
Yeah. Yes, very much so, yeah.
Do you think you'll outgrow your interest in rock?
No, I don't think I will outgrow my interest. I think what will happen is, I would imagine would happen, is in, say, 10 years or so, I'm going to be on the age group of the passion for new music. At which point, I would imagine by that point, and long before that point, other editors would be ensconced who would really be on top of it. And we have a young staff now, and I will always be a young staff. And so, you know, I don't think it's essential. And the magazine does not reflect my musical taste, as it happens. I mean, my musical taste is very eclectic, and I think everything from classical to reggae to African to Greek music to new rock to hardcore, the lot. Very often we publish stuff I just don't like, but I recognize that, you know, other people like and they want to read about it.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.